Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Our region has faced major economic changes and challenges in the past decade. But if you know our region's history, the story of boom and bust, renewal, and recession is an all too familiar story. When a steel mill closed in Weirton, West Virginia, it was heartbreaking for people like Bert Jennings.
So many good guys worked down there. So many families grew out of that mill. It's sad.
Also, in the first half of the 1900s, good jobs brought many African Americans to the coalfields from the Deep South. But as jobs became scarce, many moved away from the region.
This has been a story of African American struggle and striving that we can trace through American history because we're always getting kicked out or moved from where we settle down.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Growing up, I could not wait to leave for the city and get out of the mountains. But as I've gotten older, I'm often surprised to hear stories of our buried history. That's one thing I really enjoy about hosting this show, discovering that we have a complex and extraordinary history, and that some of the challenges my generation is facing are similar to the obstacles our parents and grandparents faced. And that brings us to 23-year-old Ella Jennings.
And I went out and talked to community members like I had never before. It just changed how I view the city.
She's from Weirton, not far from Pittsburgh, in West Virginia's northern panhandle, steel country. Here, the decline of the American steel industry has had a catastrophic impact, including on Ella's family. Part of why Ella wanted to leave was cultural. Like me, she felt she needed to leave West Virginia if she wanted to succeed and be happy. One of the biggest events to happen to her hometown was when Weirton Steel filed for bankruptcy. The company was the town's biggest employer. The steelmaking factory used to employ more than 12,000 people. Ella was only 7 when it went bankrupt in 2003. The basic oxygen plant, which was a part of Weirton Steel, was closed in 2005 by the mill's new owners, ISG. Fast forward to 2019, and something changed for her in how she viewed her hometown. She began collecting interviews from her family and neighbors for a podcast called What Happened to Weirton? Let's listen to the introduction of this series.
Earlier this year, on a Saturday morning, I stood anxiously with a crowd of Weirton natives and former steelworkers on a hillside in Weirton, West Virginia, overlooking Weirton Steel's basic oxygen plant, or BOP. Thousands of people had contributed to the steelmaking process and the huge structure. Now, they were offering their final goodbyes. An implosion crew far down below had already sounded the one-minute warning with an air horn. I held out my microphone in anticipation, not sure what to expect. And then... My dad was there with me. He had worked in the BOP for a year in 1990, and then all over the mill as a firefighter from 1994 to 2004. He was interviewed by a reporter for WTOV9, a local news outlet, and I think his voice captured the mood as we watched a piece of our history collapse into a cloud of dust.
It's sad. It is sad. I mean, so many good guys worked down there. So many families grew out of that mill. It's sad. And then really good men and women worked in there. It's sad for me.
As the crowd slowly walked away, a man asked me what I was recording the implosion for. After I explained, he commented that, "You noticed no one was clapping." I was somewhat of an emotional wreck the rest of the day. I even cried a few times. But a year ago, I probably wouldn't have given it a second thought. It wasn't until after I started this project that I found myself caring about the town. Growing up, I hated Weirton. It was a place where people always reminisced about the past because there wasn't much to look forward to in the present. After my parents divorced, I moved to Weirton with my mom and lived there from 2005 until I graduated from Weir High School in 2014. It wasn't an exciting place to be a kid. There are a lot of cafes around town, but not the kind for coffee. They're gambling joints with video lottery machines. Even the old Dairy Queen had been turned into a video lottery hotspot, which spurred two middle school girls to start a petition to bring back places for kids to go in the city. The most popular place for high schoolers to hang out was the Sheets parking lot. When the time came to go to college, I couldn't have been more happy. I arrived at West Virginia University ready to forget everything before my freshman year of college. And for a long time, I did do just that. I enrolled in journalism classes and found myself happily removed from anything to do with the Ohio Valley. But as I matured, I realized there was a story behind why my childhood home faces so many struggles. The term deindustrialization became an obsession of mine as I studied the structural issues that led to Weirton's blighted state. We are not alone in our struggles. Hundreds of small towns and cities across the U.S. and the world have faced the consequences that come along with a steady decline of manufacturing employment. Businesses close, populations decline, the middle class shrinks, and people are left wondering what happened to their once prosperous community. How do people cope when the economy advances and they're left behind in the rubble? I set out to find an answer to that question.
That was Ella Jennings in the first part of a podcast she produced for her master's project at West Virginia University called What Happened to Weirton. She spent the past year collecting interviews from her community about what the closing of their town's steel plant meant to them economically and emotionally. We're going to jump ahead a little bit to a part in her second episode, which I think captured the heart of her project and what the closing of the steel mill meant for so many people in Weirton. When she was researching Weirton, Ella came across an archived story written over a decade earlier by former Associated Press reporter Vicki Smith. The article was about a former steel plant worker named Larry Tice. And it's just heartbreaking. Ella went to go visit with Larry's wife, Mary, to hear her tell the story. I'll let Ella tell you more.
Along with several other steel mills in the early 2000s, Weirton Steel filed for bankruptcy on May 19, 2003, after reporting around $700 million in losses over the previous 5 years. The mill would be bought and sold a few times, ultimately ending with its new name, ArcelorMittal Weirton. All the while, the 3,000 workers who remained at this time were left to worry about their future. Mary said it was a very tense time for everyone in Weirton.
The change and just the worry, you know, am I going to go to work tomorrow and have a job? Am I, you know, are they going to come in and say, hey, we're going to take this off of you now, you know, no health care, you know, we're going to take another 20% or we're going to do that. It was just the not knowing, I think, half the time.
And changes did come. With Weirton Steel filing for bankruptcy, they handed over their pension fund to the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation, or PBGC, a government agency that takes over benefit payments for businesses whose pension funds are floundering or at risk. According to a PBGC press release, Weirton Steel Corporation's retirement plan, which covered about 9,200 workers and retirees, only had $530 million in assets to cover almost $1.35 billion in benefit liabilities. The PBGC executive director at the time, Steve Kandarian, was quoted saying that, I regret that the PBGC has been forced to take this course of action. Because Weirton Steel did not set aside enough money to pay for the pension promises made to its employees, some participants will not get all the benefits they earned, which is exactly what happened to Larry and his fellow steelworkers.
Per his calculations, he probably would have gotten clear around $3,000 a month. By the time that PBGC got a hold of it, he would have gotten less than $1,600 a month before taxes.
The PBGC method includes considering how long an employee has worked and how old the worker is at the time of the pension takeover. For example, if a man is 45 years old, because he is relatively young, he may see his owed pension reduced by a large magnitude. And on the other side of the equation, a man who is 65 might not see such a large reduction due to his age. The PBGC figures that a person like Larry, who was 48 at the time, could still continue working and build up a new pension under ArcelorMittal or another company. What it doesn't take into account, though, is the social and economic anxiety surrounding these situations.
He could see everything folding, I think, and, you know, because that's what he kept saying. He says, I've worked so hard for so long, gave this place my blood, sweat, and tears, and then somebody just sitting behind a desk says, nope, we're going to take half of it. And I mean, he's not the only one that said that. I mean, you know, you don't work that hard for that long in that type of a dangerous job for somebody to just, who's never walked through the mill, you know, they're nothing looking at a paper with numbers on it and say, yeah, we're going to make cuts here, we're going to make them here. And they don't realize the lives behind those numbers. It was like, how? How did we let this happen? How did other individuals have that many people's lives in their hands and just say, we don't care?
Weirton Steel also cut off healthcare benefits for all of its retirees. He contemplated taking a buyout, but wasn't sure what he would do after that. It would be hard to find a job that offered as much as the mill did.
I mean, and I think that was part of Larry's desperation too. It's like, what am I going to do? I have done nothing. I went straight from high school into this. What do I have to fall back on? What can I do if I take the buyout?
After declining the buyout and being laid off for several months, Larry returned to work in January of 2006. By then, the BOP had ceased operations as the new owners started downsizing the mill into a tin finishing plant, eliminating all parts of the steelmaking process except for the last steps. Larry was able to retain his employment, but he would no longer face the heat he thrived in for so long. He was transferred to the tin mill department, where he started learning how to operate a side trimmer, a computer-operated machine that cuts down steel coils to specific widths. Rumor has it, though, Larry was being bullied by the guys who were training him.
Once they put him in with the computer, and then the guys weren't training him properly in that, and, you know, well, you've got to get this. You've got 2 weeks to do this. And, you know, he'd come home and tell me, and I'm like, 2 weeks? Nobody's going to learn a new job in 2 weeks. And he says, well, if I don't learn a job, he said, they're going to move on to somebody else. I said, they can't. You're the oldest guy. He says, but the other guys, that they didn't want to keep him any longer to train the new people. So basically the higher ups were saying, you got to train these old guys within a couple weeks, and then the younger guys are out of there. And then they weren't training him properly.
Mary had already noticed changes in Larry by Christmas time of 2005. And things were about to unravel even further. He was becoming more quiet, more closed off. He was on his long weekend and supposed to return to the tin mill on a Thursday. Mary pushed him to see a doctor.
He went to the doctor. I was at work. And he stopped in at my job. I said, how'd it go? I don't know. I said, what did he give you? I don't know. You know, and he's like, I don't know that stuff. So, I told him, I said, okay. He said, well, I'm going to stop at the pharmacy and get it. And I'm like, okay. So when I got home, it was on the table Tuesday evening. And I looked at it and I said, you know, he says, yeah, take it. He said, in the mornings, he said, with food. And I'm like, okay.
That night, as they were watching TV, Larry randomly mentioned he wanted to get rid of some of his guns. Mary said, okay, do whatever you want. They're your guns. The next morning, Larry got up before her and had her breakfast and tea ready. She asked him what he planned to do that day. He said he wanted to get his guns cleaned and cataloged, and then decide what he wanted to keep and what he would sell.
So I got ready and got ready to leave, and we had a corner where our microwave was in the kitchen, and he was backed up against the microwave, and he says, come here, and he opened the robe up and just give me a big bear hug, and he says, I love you, and he says, I'll see you later, and I said, okay. I said, well, I'll call you later this morning. I said, find out what you want to do later.
Around 10:30 in the morning, Mary got a strange feeling and felt the need to call Larry.
He picked up the phone, and I could just hear something in his voice. And I said, what's going on? He says, nothing. And I said, what's going on? And he says, I'm so stupid. I'm so dumb. And I'm thinking, okay, he broke a dish. He stepped on the dog. He, whatever, you know, something goofy. And I said, okay, what did you do? And he says, oh, I'll show you when I get home. Or when you get home. And I said, tell me, I'm going to worry all day. No, I'll just show you when you get home. I said, okay. And I hung the phone up. And then that's when the girl that was where I worked at was sitting next to me. And I just got this sharp pain in my chest. I thought I was having a heart attack. And Carla looked at me and I said, 911. All I could just say was 911 because I thought I was having a heart attack. And it just started to subsiding. And I said, no, never mind. And I said, I picked the phone back up and tried to call, and there was no answer. And I kept calling and calling, and I thought, something's wrong.
Mary tried to have a neighbor check on him, but they were afraid of her two dogs, so they didn't go in the house. At this point, she knew she had to go home to check on Larry.
I pulled in the driveway, pulled in front of the house, and I tried the knob, and the door was unlocked. And when I went to open the door up, I seen Thor's food was there, and both dogs greeted me at the door because the kitchen door was open, and I'm like, Larry wouldn't let them eat out here together, and the food bowl was still full, but there was poop. When I opened the door, there was poop in front of the door, and I'm like, my dogs do not poop in the house. And when I walked into the kitchen, the sink was like to my left, and my breakfast dishes was soaking in there. And I'm like, Larry, I said, where are you, Larry? And I looked, and the light was on in the den where we had that's where his gun cabinet was in that. And there was stuff on the floor where he had taken it out of the bottom drawers and was, you know, getting stuff out of there. And our living room was straight through, and he was laying in front of the couch with his head toward the kitchen, and he laid like that sometimes if his back bothered him. And I said, hey, I said, are you sleeping? And the dogs followed me in to the room because I never put them back outside. And when I walked in, I looked down and his eyes were open and he was gone. And I could tell from his face, but he had shot himself, they said, in his heart. I didn't remember any of this for about 3.5 years.
Larry's medicine was still sitting on the table. He hadn't taken one dose yet.
The two dogs that knew what happened in that house are gone. I wish they could have talked back then. So, I mean, you know, between God and those two dogs and my husband, nobody knows what's happened. Larry was the type, he sheltered me a lot with different things. Didn't want me to worry. But I was a lot stronger than he ever thought I was.
Mary said there weren't any mental health programs for mill workers at the time. Only after the fact did people pay more attention. When she originally talked to Vicki Smith for the Associated Press article, she was apprehensive. But she figured if she told Larry's story, she might be able to help someone going through a similar situation.
And I found out later that there was a gentleman who was contemplating suicide and was at home alone and went to pick up the paper to read before he did, had the gun on his lap, and read the article that Vicki had wrote and said, I couldn't leave my family like this, not in the pain that woman went through, and he called for help and got help.
Mary was right. Larry's story does resonate with others. When you take someone's identity away from them, built up through years of labor and commitment, it's hard to say how they'll react. Some recover, some don't. So it makes you wonder, just like Mary did, how did we let this happen? It was the same thing I was thinking as I watched the BOP falling. All things come to an end, of course, but some end much better than others.
My heart just goes out to Miss Tice. I know it's a difficult story to share, but it's so important. I spoke with Ella to learn more about why she wanted to focus on her community's story of change and why it led her to a decision to stay in West Virginia, at least for the time being. I think the way you put it in the first episode, you said businesses close, population declines, the middle class shrinks, and people are left wondering what happened to their once prosperous communities. How do people cope when the economy advances? That's a pretty big question that I think a lot of communities are trying to figure out. What was your strategy in trying to really tackle this question?
So my strategy was really to just get out and talk to as many people as I could about, you know, their experience living in Weirton and then going through the decline of the American steel industry. And sitting down with these community members who, before this, I would have never tried to contact or, you know, reach out to or talk to. You know, I was very disconnected from the community. But when you start talking to these people, something in you changes where I just found a greater connection to the community in Weirton and the pain and, you know, sometimes the lack of hope. And I think that's really what changed my viewpoint is the more I talk to community members, the more I care. So, you know, I found that article by Vicki Smith, and she talked about, you know, Mary Tice and her husband, Larry, you know, who, passed away. So I was really floored by that article, and it made me, that was like the first article that I found that really, you know, got me going and saying that, you know, there was a real tragedy here, and people, you know, some people didn't make it through, you know, and I needed to go talk to these people, and these are the, you know, Mary Tice, like, people like her can express the real pain, you know, the social pain and the consequences of, you know, this deindustrialization. So, really, it was just trying to get out and talk to people, and, you know, anyone you talk to in Weirton has a story about how they were affected. So that's really just what it takes, is getting out and talking to people and asking them for their stories, because, you know, there's going to be one.
Mm. And Larry Tice's story, such a heartbreaking story. And he took his own life amid this crisis and his company cutting benefits and things like that. It was such a heartbreaking story to hear. And I really appreciate you sharing that voice and that story.
Just to have someone, you know, talk about their trauma like that, it's a very sensitive thing, but she was brave enough to do it, and I couldn't have been more thankful for her to, you know, tell her story like that. Just hearing the emotion, it really gets to you, and, you know, even when I was editing that story, I cried. So, you can just, like, sort of, in a way, start relating to what that person has been through. It makes just the bigger picture so much more sad, I guess.
And how do people cope when the economy advances? Back to that big question that you asked, did you find the answer or more questions?
I'd say, you know, what it seems to be is just people just keep hanging on, and that's all there really is to do. If you don't get up and leave like so many people did, you know, you just hang on to your hometown and hope for the best. People are really proud to be from Weirton, and I think a lot of that comes from just like that grit from the steel industry. You know, they were able to produce so much for the country, and I think that's just left a strong culture of pride in Weirton, and I think that pride keeps pushing people forward.
What is your hope for Weirton? What would you like to see happen?
Well, I really just hope that, one, the opioid epidemic can be better addressed and that continue to be worked on because, you know, I mean, I have family who's been affected by the opioid epidemic, of course. I'm sure everyone has at this point. But I just hope that there's some way that, I just hope that Weirton, just like it used to be in the old days where, you know, everyone had a chance for economic success. Let's not say everyone had a chance. You know, there's still like a lot of class and racial disparities, but there was a more widespread chance of economic security in people's lives. I'm hoping that one day that will be able to return and people can live comfortable lives. No one's looking for excessive amounts of wealth or, you know, some kind of fancy lifestyle. People just want to be able to live comfortable lives. And that's really just what I hope for the people in Weirton, that, you know, things can be comfortable again.
And you're living close by Weirton now. You've kind of moved back home. Do you plan on staying there? And do you hope to help contribute to any kind of changes that might happen for a better future there?
Yeah, and that's really funny because I used to think, you know, I'm going to get as far away from the Ohio Valley as possible. but now, you know, I'm living with my dad in Wellsburg again.
Which is right outside of Weirton, right?
Yeah, so Wellsburg's, it's only 15 miles south of Weirton. So I'm living in Wellsburg and working in Wheeling. You know, I'm working with, I'm doing some work with, through AmeriCorps with Grow Ohio Valley, which is focusing on food justice and food security in the Ohio Valley. And it feels good to contribute to the Valley because I never thought I would care to. But now that, you know, I know the story of my hometown and I know what people have gone through and I want to be able to help return the Ohio Valley back to the state that it used to be in some capacity. You know, I used to think I would be unhappy if I was living up here, but I'm really not. I just view the Valley in a different light now, and I'm happy to be up here helping.
Again, that was Ella Jennings, host and producer of a podcast series called What Happened to Weirton? The project was part of her master's thesis in journalism at West Virginia University. We've posted the entire series on our website, wvpublic.org. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping farmers share their food with your family every week at your local farmers market. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
I grew up in Wyoming County, West Virginia, deep in the heart of coal country. But so much of the coal we produce is metallurgical coal, which is used to make steel. The decline of the American steel industry is tied to my story, too. You can follow the boom and bust cycle of coal in our region throughout the years and trace it back to those same cycles in the steel industry. Of course, there are other forces at play that affect coal employment. Things like natural gas, overseas markets, and environmental regulations all play a part in the employment of coal miners. Today, we're exploring how these economic changes affect people, our friends, our neighbors, and how entire communities can be uprooted by the closing of a local factory or layoffs in the coal mines. Next, we'll hear about a community that has historical roots in both the steel and coal industries. It's the story of Lynch, Kentucky. And if that town sounds familiar, you might recognize it from a story we aired 2 years ago as part of our series, The Struggle to Stay. Derek Akow's family is part of what's known as the Black Diaspora of Eastern Kentucky, a largely overlooked part of Appalachia's story. Back in the early 1900s, the coalfields of our region were once multicultural hubs filled with immigrants from other countries like Italy and Greece. And many African Americans from the Deep South also came to work in the mines and later the steel mills. But the decline in the coal industry led many African Americans to leave Appalachia in search of work. They went to cities like Detroit and Chicago. Of course, it wasn't just African Americans who left. White folks left too, but layoffs often hit people from the African American communities the hardest. Because today we're talking about communities in transition, we were reminded of Derek Akow's story and how his family has been uprooted several times because of changes in the coal industry. Let's listen to part of this story. This is the second part in a series about Derek Akow. Here's a recap of what happened in his first story. Derek got a college football scholarship, and he thought that was going to be his ticket out. But a serious neck injury led him to dropping out of school and coming back home. We pick up the story back in Harlan County, where at the time, Derek was living with his mom and his grandma. Reporter Benny Becker followed Derek and his family for about a year and recorded their story. And a quick heads up, you'll hear a racial slur a few times in this story.
Generation after generation, people in Derek's family have felt pressure to move away from home. The struggle to stay is a central part of Derek's family history and the history of his hometown, a little place called Lynch. How do you feel about the name of this town?
You know, it don't bother me much. You know, I just wish it was named different because, you know, Lynch and you got lynchings and stuff like that.
Lynch was actually named after Thomas Lynch. He was an executive at U.S. Steel, the company that built this coal camp town back in 1917. Today, there are yard signs posted all around Lynch to let everyone know that the town is celebrating 100 years of existence, here at the foot of Kentucky's highest peak, which happens to be named Black Mountain.
Black Mountain, living Lynch, in a black community, you know. what can you say to it, you know?
I asked Eric if he knew much about his family's history and how they'd come to live in Lynch.
My grandma and my mom down here, they really don't say much about it. Karita knows more about it. She probably talks about it the most.
Derek's talking about his cousin, Karita Brown.
Hello, my name is Karita Brown. I am a visiting assistant professor at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm also full-time faculty in the Department of Sociology at University of California at Los Angeles.
Karita has done a lot of research about how generations of African Americans have moved in and out of coal towns like Lynch. She's actually writing a book about it. Here's how Derek describes her.
She does a lot of interviews around here. Everybody knows who she is. One thing that everybody loves about her is her hair. It's like really poofy and curly. Just beautiful. I love it. That's why I'm trying to get my hair like hers. Big and natural.
Karita told me she's not surprised that Derek hasn't heard much about how his family first came to Lynch.
Memory is a very complicated thing with the African-American experience. One of my mentors, Tony Bogues, calls slavery a historical catastrophe, a shattering of who you are and where you come from. You don't always want to be remembering that. Their lives, their roots, their origin stories started in Kentucky, and their parents weren't necessarily trying to tell them all their horror stories or what they endured to get there.
Even though it's not something Derek's talked about much, I think that if you want to understand Derek's struggle to stay, you have to understand that many parts of his struggle are forces that his family has been dealing with for generations.
This has been a story of African-American struggle and striving that we can trace through American history because we're always getting kicked out or moved from where we settle down.
So now we're going to speed through 100 years of Derek's family history, starting with the origin story.
How the hell did all these black folks get to Harlan County, Kentucky? When the mining industry came into eastern Kentucky, we're at the point of world war and the country needs steel. Coal is one of the products to make steel. So the mining industries found themselves with an insatiable need for labor.
Mining companies like the one that built and owned Lynch sent labor agents far and wide to recruit coal miners. One place where they recruited was Alabama, where Derek's great-granddad came from.
They were in a dire situation in the late 1800s, early 1900s in Alabama, and leaving Alabama was more of an escape.
Slavery had technically been abolished, but many African Americans were still trapped doing forced labor in abusive conditions. Some were stuck in unfair farming contracts, and others were arrested, often on flimsy charges, then sold to industries that needed workers. Many of these leased convicts ended up working in coal mines, where about 1 in 20 workers would die each year. It was dangerous to stay in Alabama, but it was also dangerous to leave. Derek's great-granddad used to tell a story about one scary encounter that happened while he was traveling to Kentucky.
He was unsure if they were going to kill him right there.
Cynthia Harrington remembers how her dad, Derek's great-granddad, used to tell the story.
He used to get drunk, and he basically told us the same story when he got drunk about how he hoboed, we call it hitchhike, from Alabama because he had heard about the jobs in the mines. He said he was walking, and these white men saw him one day. And they said, "Hey, nigga, where you going?" So he told them that he was going to Kentucky to get a job. And they said, "We heard that niggas can preach." So they said to him, "Nigga, preach." He said he had to do it because he was a little afraid. And then he said after he preached, They said, well, we heard niggas like to dance. They said, nigga, dance. And, you know, once he danced and they taunted him some more, they let him go.
That was Cynthia Harrington talking about her dad who moved to Harlan County, Kentucky in the early 1900s. Benny Becker produced that story about Derek Acow's family back in 2017. You can listen to the entire Struggle to Stay series on our website, wvpublic.org. There have been a few developments in Derek's life recently. He is still in Harlan County, Kentucky. A few months ago, he became the proud father of a new baby. He's now working in the coal industry. Also, his cousin, Carita Brown, who, as we just heard, has been working for several years to document the oral histories of Eastern Kentucky and has published a book. It's called Gone Home, Race and Roots Through Appalachia.
You know that I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved.
We like a tree.
We like a tree.
African-American history is often overlooked in the national media when they talk about Appalachia. But today there are still places, like Lynch, Kentucky, where you can find people who can tell you about that history and the diverse culture that is a part of who we are. If, like Carita Brown, you just spend the time on their porches listening. Our next guest also did a great deal of his research listening on the front porches of his friends and neighbors. Cicero Fain is the author of Black Huntington, an Appalachian Story. In the 19th century, the railroads also brought many African Americans to work in Appalachia. Many people were drawn to Huntington, West Virginia, to work in the Chesapeake and Ohio train yards. One thing Fain learned while researching his book is an informal system of communication, something Fain calls the grapevine telegraph, which allowed blacks, both freed and slaves, to work together and communicate with each other as they traveled throughout West Virginia. Many of them were on their way to Ohio, where they could find freedom if they were slaves, as well as jobs and better opportunities up north. Inside Appalachia, associate producer Eric Douglas spoke with Fain about why he became interested in this research and how he was inspired by the stories he heard from old-timers.
I remember sitting on the porch, and that was one of the things that I've talked about recently, is the front porch, these kind of front porch stories. Or episodes where I just sat on the front porch, listened to people talk, and slowly but surely, you know, it seeped, the various conversations and the personality seeped into my consciousness in a kind of inchoate way. You know, it wasn't concrete, it wasn't tangible, but the voices and the experiences and the personalities kind of floated around in the consciousness. And then when I got the fellowship to go to Ohio State, and it just occurred to me that Mrs. Edna Duckworth had compiled this small pamphlet of local black history, and so that kind of spurred me to say, you know, maybe there's something here between my porch conversations, between what the little bit important pieces that local folks had done, maybe I can kind of collect, organize, and focus them into a narrative. In comparison to the Deep South, West Virginia was progressive. Social relations, politically, you know, the fact that you could, you know, black people could vote, and not have to worry about you know, the impediments, the barriers that the Deep South employed to the franchise. And so I think there was enough space, you know, within Huntington, within West Virginia, that black people could move up the economic ladder, could move up, even if they couldn't necessarily move up the social ladder interracially.
Right.
But there was enough going on within the community, within not only, you know, the community with Huntington, but the community regionally and nationally, that I don't think black folks went around saying, you know, I wish I had more access.
Yeah, one thing that really intrigued me when you were talking as Huntington became a kind of a Black social hub, that people were traveling from Charleston, from Beckley to Huntington. And back in those days, that was you know, now it's a 45-minute drive. Back then, sure, it was probably an all-day excursion on a train to get there, or on, you know, literally on wagons or that kind of thing. It's amazing that the efforts they went to, but they did it just to be social.
Yes. You know, that is, to me, that is noteworthy. And in fact, you know, even when I was growing up, you know, I spent the bulk of my teenage years at First Baptist Church. And we had a progressive situation there, a progressive pastor, Reverend Charles Smith. But I definitely remember church groups coming up from Beckley or some of the smaller towns in southern West Virginia. You know, not only coming to the church, but the fact that Huntington had a vibrant commercial and cultural scene. You know, it, for many people, it was the big city.
What surprised you the most in your research for the book?
I think the most surprising thing to me was the Grapevine Telegraph of White Sulphur Springs. And the fact that White Sulphur Springs, the employment of slaves, opened up a Pandora's box, because it afforded the opportunity for Black employees and Black travelers and slaves to really communicate, socialize, strategize, and subvert the prevailing social paradigm and racial paradigm.
What do you hope readers take away from the book?
That it's important to recognize that Black people contributed to the formation of Huntington, the region, and the state, and allowed Huntington, assisted Huntington in becoming the economic cultural powerhouse that it became. But I think there are real lessons embedded within that story that speaks to the ability of a people to move forward.
That was Cicero Fain, the author of Black Huntington, an Appalachian Story, speaking with Eric Douglas. To wrap up our show, there is something I'm really excited to tell you about. You've already heard it, whether you noticed it or not, and it's one of the staples of this show, music. Our producers often switch out our music while producing Inside Appalachia, depending on the story we're telling, and that still might happen from time to time. But Matt Jackford helped create some music of our own. Matt is a musician and composer in his own right. He's also the host of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Classical Music Show on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. And now he's created music specially for Inside Appalachia, and we're really proud of it.
So was this an unusual or challenging request? Like, I remember when I was talking to you, I was thinking, we want it to still stay true to the roots of Appalachia and the traditional music, but not necessarily the stereotypical stuff. And it just seemed like kind of a tall order.
Right. Yeah. Well, it is a fine line to walk, you know.
Right.
If you go one way, then you're not Appalachian enough. And if you go the other way, then you're too Appalachian and you're being stereotypical and, you know, banjos and fiddles and things like that.
Right. And it all depends on what kind of scale you're looking at and whose background you're talking about and things like that. But I was so excited to hear what you came up with.
I had thought of, I actually was taking a nap, woke up, and sort of heard it in my head and wrote it down really quickly.
Oh, nice.
And that's where the theme came from. And eventually sort of built it up using this whistle theme. I thought that was a cool way of, you know, being Appalachian but not too Appalachian. There's the steady backbeat with claps. There's fiddle. That does the theme, too, and some solo work at the end. That's done by Joseph Ceballos, a good friend of mine. And then the percussion below, you know, I was done by John Query, a great friend of mine as well. And he, you know, I didn't really give him much direction. I just told him, hey, bring in your djembe and hey, bring in the triangle and some hi-hat and things like
djembe?
That. Djembe? Djembe is a hand drum. It's actually an African hand drum.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, and so I thought it felt like it worked really well with the song, so I thought hand drumming would work better than a drum set, say. And I think it actually, as you'll hear, I think it goes really well together with the song.
So at the end of the show, we always say, and until next time, thanks for joining us as we journey throughout Appalachia. And to me, that just felt like, you know, some kind of journey. And, you know, sometimes there were really, you know, there could be some serious moments and there's also like an upbeat feel to it where no matter what we heard, you know, going on sort of beside us or around us, like we still just kind of kept journeying. And I think it fits so well to what we try to do on Inside Appalachia. It was like magic.
Right. Well, thank you for that. I appreciate that. Yeah, I think it takes, you know, the sort of pentatonic scale from that's native to Appalachia, as well as, you know, the blues sort of notes that are thrown in there as well. And then, you know, Appalachian's all about having a good groove in the song, and I think that kind of flew with it. So it's gritty, but it's also upbeat.
Yeah.
How do you, when you go to record these things, how do you get the feel of Appalachia and still stay away from the stereotypical stuff? I mean, that was great because it felt like home.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I mean, I think growing up here really helps, you know, and really helps, you know, instill the Appalachian, you know, vibe, the Appalachian culture, the music, you know, ingrains it in my subconscious, I think, you know, going to things like the Vandalia Festival, for instance, or like going to Mountain Stage and listening to, you know, sort of Appalachian music on there and just being around, hearing the culture and absorbing it, I think, has helped me to create my own, you know, Appalachian style.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I love it, and I'm really honored that we can have it on the show.
Well, thanks, Jessica. Yeah, and I'm glad to be able to write it for you all, and it's been a great opportunity to be able to write some music that's, you know, sort of just deep within, you know, my soul, you know, to be able to bring it out and share it with everybody.
Matt Jackford, award-winning composer and radio host here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about this music and for talking about the music with us and for giving us these beautiful sounds for the show. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate you all, you and Roxy Todd, giving me, you know, an opportunity to express my voice. And I'd like to thank our performers, Jim Lang, Joseph Ceballos, and John Query, who did a great job throughout this whole process.
In addition to our lovely new theme music, Matt Jackford also wrote and produced about 10 other songs for Inside Appalachia. You'll be hearing them in our stories and in music breaks here on our show. Here's one that I especially love. It's called Mountain Wisp. Today on Inside Appalachia, we heard about several communities that were uprooted because of economic pressure and how people become uprooted, too, when their town begins to change and people leave. I can remember when the 2001 flood hit Mullins, West Virginia. I wasn't living there at the time, and all I could think was, thank God we got out of there before the flood hit. Over the years, I've revisited the town for stories and reports and realized that there are so many good people there still working to make a living, and I still love the place too. And just like Ella, the WVU graduate student we heard from earlier in the show, I too hope that there might be a brighter future for my hometown. Nothing fancy or elaborate, just a basic living and fair chance at the American dream. Ella also pointed out that not everyone has an equal opportunity to live the American dream. Some starting lines, like those in many minority communities, are even further back than we'd like to admit. So to preserve and remember, we have to keep this in mind as we look to the past in order to move forward. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and Ella Jennings with West Virginia University's Reeds College of Media. Music in today's show was provided by Matt Jackford, Dinosaur Burps, the Mount Sinai Spirituals, Lee Roosevelt, Kevin McLeod, Kai Engel, and Spencer Elliott. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter. On our website, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.